Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Amanpour Hour. Here's where we're headed this week.
New U.S. military aid rushing to Ukraine to halt Putin's advances. The Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba joins us.
Putin is a political animal who can sense fear.
Then, as American colleges wrestle with political activism and campus safety, author Salman Rushdie, who narrowly survived an assassination attempt, says free speech is more important than ever.
The temperature is so high right now. There's so much anger that it's very hard for anybody to listen to anybody.
Also this hour, renowned photographer Platon on FaceTime with the people shaping our world, from Muhammad Ali to Vladimir Putin.
And then Putin turns to me and in perfect English, he says, "I love the Beatles."
And from my archive, it's 30 years to the day since Nelson Mandela cast the historic vote that made him president in South Africa's first democratic elections. His trusted former aide tells me how he transformed her life.
So you describe yourself as a racist. I mean, that is shocking for me to hear. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Hallelujah, the word of Ukraine's foreign minister as the United States finally passed that long-delayed and much-needed aid package for Ukraine's fight against Russia. And it seems divine intervention didn't just strike Dmytro Kuleba. Colleagues of the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, says he prayed for guidance on the issue. That and some pretty stiff intelligence briefings from the experts. And President Zelensky says speed now is of the essence. His army chief says their situation on the Eastern Front has, quote, worsened significantly. While the United States Army commander in Europe says Putin's force is now 15% larger than when it invaded 2 years ago. And here's President Biden.
This package is literally an investment, not only in Ukraine's security, but in Europe's security, in our own security.
And of course, the six-month delay has cost countless Ukrainian lives and territory. My first guest, Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, joins me from Kyiv, warning that the era of peace in Europe is over. Foreign Minister, welcome to the program from Kyiv. And I just wanted to ask you on this morning, you must feel very relieved, right? It's been 6 to 7 months of waiting anxiously.
It's good to have America back. It's better when good things happen later than do not happen at all. But I do agree that this package should have been passed much, much earlier, and things could would turn differently on many accounts. But now we are working on preparing ourselves to receive the first aid of package, the first package of aid announced by President Biden. Our soldiers on the front line are waiting for it. Our society received kind of a morale boost. And it's also an important message to all our partners, a message from Washington that the struggle continues, the fight for freedom and democracy goes on.
Can I ask you specifically, if you can, tell me what are the most important things you're waiting for?
Well, when you fight a war, you need everything. There is no detail that you do not need in fighting the war. We need air defense to protect our cities, and we need artillery ammunition and artillery systems to protect our soldiers and to liberate our territories. These are the two key elements. What we do not see on this package is a battery of Patriots, but we keep working with the U.S. administration on mobilizing more batteries from other countries in short perspective.
Let me ask you to react to what senators like J.D. Vance, certain Republicans who oppose sending aid to Ukraine, they basically say, do the math. In other words, you know, you can't, it just doesn't add up. Ukraine needs more soldiers. It needs more material than the U.S. can provide. What's your answer to that?
It is true that the key to victory of Ukraine is a united front of all countries. We saw that in the meantime, while the Congress was debating the law, Germany was making powerful decisions. Other European countries were announcing important aid packages. So United States are not alone in supporting Ukraine. In fact, we see that European countries are increasing their support to Ukraine. Ukraine itself increased its own production of weapons and will continue to ramp up its production. And the question to the members of Congress that you refer to is simple. You know, if all of these countries are united around the goal of Ukraine's victory, maybe it's because they see that this victory is important, is also a matter of their security and prosperity. Mm-hmm. And whatever the price of supporting Ukraine today is, the price of fixing the world if Russia wins in Ukraine will be much, much higher.
Do you expect a massive Russian attempt to take advantage of the window before this aid gets to you?
Well, everyone in the world should remember that every delay in providing sending assistance to Ukraine is compensated by the bravery and sacrifice of our soldiers. But this is not kind of compensation that not you personally, but our partners should be willing us to pay, because these are real people and their lives matter. And everything we lost in between last autumn and now is because we didn't have, our soldiers did not have enough of weapons. They have no shortage of bravery and the will to sacrifice themselves for their country.
And now the issue of conscription, of lowering the draft age, you're trying to get young men back, those who fled and the fighting. How is that going? Do you expect to have many more people drafted to the front?
The parliament passed the law setting, in fact, a couple of laws setting up the new framework for conscription in Ukraine. And our army will receive new soldiers and officers to fight, because what is at stake here is the survival of a nation, the survival of a sovereign country in 21st century. And we know our history. Those who refused to fight for Ukraine with arms, with weapons in their arms, in the beginning of the 20th century, when we lost our independence to Bolshevik Russia, became afterwards victims of Stalin's repressions, of Stalin's genocide against the Ukrainian people, and we fell victims of Russification of Ukraine. We all know what follows when we lose, and therefore we will keep fighting. Mm. What we do need is our partners to firmly believe that Ukraine's victory is attainable. And second, to have no fear towards Putin, because Putin is a political animal who can sense fear. And when he does, he becomes more aggressive. If he sees the strengths, if he senses the strengths, as it was recently demonstrated by, as the one recently demonstrated by the Congress, he will be forced to step back.
And finally, I want to ask you whether you notice and plan to take part in a mission to persuade Trump. Let's just say he wins again. We've seen quite a few Western leaders have gone to America to meet with him privately, and we're told it was to encourage him to encourage Congress to pass this law, and they brought intelligence and all the rest of it. We understand Baltic leaders, Polish leaders, are also trying to persuade Trump and Trump's allies that this must continue, this aid for Ukraine, and saying, you know, that this is also good for America because it creates American jobs. Are you, in a way, pleasantly surprised that this Congress, this MAGA group in Congress, passed this law, passed this bill?
I said from the very beginning, in an interview to you, by the way, when you asked me whether we have plan B, if the Congress does not pass the law, I said, we don't, we only have plan A. And if I'm not mistaken, following that interview, I was heavily criticized for making no plans B. But our strategy is always to get the best for Ukraine, even when very few believe that we will succeed in the end. So we had plan A, the vote, the successful vote in the Congress. In the end, we got it. And there was an enormous amount of effort of many people in many countries behind that result. But this is how you win wars. If you have plan B, make no mistake, you will end up with plan B. But this is not what will save Ukraine. Ukraine will win only if it focuses together with its partners on plan A. And this is what we will be doing, irrespective of the name of the President of the United States or the names of the members of Congress of the United States or any other country in the world.
Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, thank you for joining me from Kyiv. Coming up later on the program, famed photographer Platon on meeting Putin at gunpoint and discussing their favorite Beatles song. But before that, Salman Rushdie tells me what he wanted to do immediately after being stabbed and the premonition he had just before.
In retrospect, I'd have done well to pay attention to the dream.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm a health reporter and have been for 15 years. And even I feel overwhelmed by some of the things I read about the stuff we're eating.
My colleague Meg Terrell wanted to take a deep dive into something you've probably heard a lot about recently. Ultra-processed foods. There is a lot to learn there, some fascinating stuff. And some of it is probably going to change the way you shop. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the program, and we turn now to the struggle to balance free speech with safety, which is playing out on college campuses across the United States and in other parts of the world. There's a long history of student activism against war in the US, lest we forget Vietnam. Now, thousands of students are protesting Israel's war on Gaza, with many facing heavy-handed discipline, suspension, arrest, and expulsion. Some Jewish students, meanwhile, say criticism of Israel is spilling into anti-Semitism. My next guest knows the importance of free speech better than most. He almost lost his life over it. Salman Rushdie lived with the threat of assassination for years after Iran's supreme leader called for his death over the book The Satanic Verses. Then, in 2022, nearly 35 years after it was published, Rushdie was repeatedly stabbed as he was about to give a public lecture in New York. He was lucky to escape with his life, and now, in a brave defense of free speech, he's written about his near death in Knife: Meditations After an Attempted Murder. He joined me this week from New York to tell me his book is also about the triumph of love over hate. Can I just start by asking how you are? How are you feeling?
I'm okay, you know. I mean, I think I'm surprised myself by how well I feel. I think I'm pretty much repaired. Thank you.
Salman, I find it really interesting because you say you don't believe in miracles, and you also, you know, admit that your recovery is miraculous. But also you say you don't believe in premonitions, and you did have something that we might call a premonition or a dream just before going to Chautauqua, just before going to make this speech. We've asked you to read just a little bit of that graph.
Yeah, I had a nightmare. Two nights before I flew to Chautauqua, I had a dream about being attacked by a man with a spear, a gladiator in a Roman amphitheater. There was an audience roaring for blood. I was rolling about on the ground, trying to escape the gladiator's downward thrusts and screaming. It was not the first time I'd had such a dream. On two earlier occasions, as my dream self rolled frantically around, my actual sleeping self, also screaming, threw its body, my body, out of bed. And I awoke as I crashed painfully to the bedroom floor.
So those were those two times. This time, your wife woke you up and you didn't crash to the floor. But you said to her, I don't want to go. Honestly, it gives me chills, that.
Yeah, I was very spooked by the dream. And that's what my initial response was, to say, look, I don't want to go. And then, you know, I woke up a bit more and I thought, really, we don't run our lives on the basis of whether we had a bad dream or not. And it's just a dream. And of course I should go. But in retrospect, I'd have done well to pay attention to the dream.
Salman, you talk about the A, that is the assailant, the assassin, the asinine. I mean, quite early on, before you even recovered, you were grappling with whether you should go to see him, confront him, talk to him, understand his motivation.
Yeah. I mean, that was my first thought, was as a kind of journalistic impulse to go and sit in a room with them and say, okay, tell me why you did it. And then, you know, I read this story of Samuel Beckett, who was also stabbed in Paris in a street by a pimp. And he actually did go to the court and asked the man, why did you do it? And all the man said was, I don't know, sir, I'm sorry. And I thought, well, that doesn't get you very far, does it? It doesn't explain anything. And I thought maybe if I did meet this guy, I would get some banality of that kind. You know, I didn't think I would get remorse. There doesn't seem to be any sign of remorse. But I thought I'd get some cliche. And so pointless. Mm-hmm. And I thought actually I would do better to use the skill I've got of imagination and storytelling to try and imagine myself into his head and work out a kind of coherent portrait of somebody who could have done this.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, that chapter. And I want to ask you, because I think we know, because the assailant gave an interview to one of the New York tabloids, that he didn't read the satanic verses. He didn't sound like he had any motivation for this.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't read. He said he'd read two pages of something I'd written. He didn't say what. And that he'd seen a couple of YouTube videos. And that was enough for him to decide to commit murder. I mean, it shows me that indoctrination can be a very powerful force. You know, that, and there are people, like I suspect this young man of being, who kind of need to be led, who need to be given a direction in life because they don't feel that they have it.
And what about in New York, where you live? You can see campuses roiling. You can see it spreading across the United States. The issue of free speech is being, you know, really challenged. What do you make of students today getting themselves into this kind of situation?
Well, you know, students demonstrated against the Vietnam War. I mean, it's not the first time. And of course, students should have the right of protest and historically often have, and that's it's right. What's happening is that very often that right of protest is spilling over into menacing remarks and behavior. And so a lot of Jewish students feel unsafe on campus. And it gives the administrators an almost impossible job, that whatever they do is wrong, really. Mm. And the temperature is so high right now. There's so much anger that it's very hard for anybody to listen to anybody. And it's a very dark time for the academy, I think, in America. Universities across the country are wrestling with this, and and many of them, you know, not doing a perfect job.
A fascinating conversation, and you can watch the entire talk with Salman Rushdie online at amanpour.com. Coming up on the programme, from my archive, as South Africa celebrates 30 years of democracy, Nelson Mandela's private secretary told me how he changed her life, the life of a racist. But first, how the man behind the camera captures the faces shaping our world.
This is the face of power in Russia.
Welcome back to the program. My next guest is one of the world's best-known photographers, whose portraits have defined the pages of Time, Rolling Stone, The New Yorker. He goes simply by one name, Platon. And for more than two decades, he's been up close and personal with the most influential figures of our era, from Muhammad Ali to Vladimir Putin. His new book, The Defenders, is about giving a voice to real people fighting back and standing up for human rights. And that is the subject of my letter from London this week. Platon, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Your latest book is called Defenders. What do you mean by that title?
Well, it's a superhero title, but the people who are defenders of human rights they're ordinary people, but they do extraordinary things. Mm. And we often think of human rights defenders and activists, we always talk about them in a certain way. Many of them have been victimized by history, by society, and faced horrendous hardships. Mm. But they've, with all those challenges, they do extraordinary things. So I thought we should start to change the narrative and see them as a new set of cultural heroes.
You like very much your image of Muhammad Ali, who's by no means an ordinary person, but he captured the imagination of ordinary people all over the world. So explain to me this picture. How did this come about?
He was very frail when I took this. I believe it's one of his last, maybe even the last big photo shoot he did. And he'd lost control of his once most powerful arms and fists.
Because of the Parkinson's?
Yeah. But when he felt me drape the American flag over his shoulders, you can just see a bit of it here, he was compelled to hold up his hands in that defiant pose. And it was really moving. His wife actually started to cry a little bit. And he was trembling, trying to keep his hands in that position. So I said to him, Muhammad, you are the greatest. Please teach me to be great. How can my generation be as great as your generation had to be during the civil rights era in America? So I had to get close to him, and he whispered in my ear and he said, I have a confession to make. So I said, what is it? And he said, I wasn't as great as I said I was. Oh my goodness, I freaked out. That's the biggest confession I ever heard in my life. And I said, the whole world knows you as Ali the greatest. But then he said, you misunderstand me. I'll tell you what was great. And it wasn't me. It was that people saw themselves in my struggle and my story.
Let's go now to the pictures of world leaders. So this was for the Time magazine cover Person of the Year of 2008. Mm. You know, it is an extraordinary picture of him. You have two pictures. One is just a face on. I chose this one. Mm. Everything you want to know about Putin is summed up in that picture, as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, he's performing power.
Exactly.
It's a whole process of intimidation when you come into contact with power. You know, I was told that it would be in the halls of the Kremlin, and I was picked up, driven to the gates by a former KGB BMW, and then you get to the gates and the car turns, goes out of Moscow into a dark, bleak Gothic forest. It's really intimidating. You have no idea what's going on. And I got to the most scary building I've ever seen. It was his private residence, his Dasha, in the middle of the forest. Two-story high security walls, snipers everywhere. I'm led into the building at gunpoint. And
literally?
Yeah. And then the entourage comes in, and he has two translators who whisper into his ear, whole team of advisors and a gang of bodyguards. And I nervously said, Mr. President, before we capture a moment of history, I have a question to ask you. I said, I was brought up by my mum and dad listening to the Beatles. And I'd like to know if you ever listened to the Beatles. And in Russian, he orders the two translators and all his advisors out of the room immediately. The bodyguards stay. And then Putin turns to me and in perfect English, he says, I love the Beatles. So I said, I didn't know you spoke English. He said, I speak perfect English. So I said, who's your favourite Beatle? He said, Paul. I said, interesting. What's your favourite song? And I said, is it Back in the USSR? And then he said, no, my favourite song is Yesterday.
That is before, I think, he made his big speech, you know, warning the West that he wouldn't tolerate any expansion, before he invaded and annexed Crimea, before, obviously, the second full-scale invasion, and before he became a pariah. And in those intervening years, you also took pictures of the opposition, notably Pussy Riot. So let's talk about this.
Everyone probably knows them like this, you know, hardcore feminist punk rock group who speak truth to power against Putin's excessive nationalism. But what happens if you remove those aggressive masks? You see something different. And this is Nadia and Masha after they were released from prison. They paid a heavy price for their support of women's rights and LGBTQ rights in their country.
Amazing experiences. And when we come back, the story behind Platon's photo shoot at Trump Tower. In retrospect, a premonition of Trump's presidency. Then, later in the hour, 30 years of democracy in South Africa. My conversation with Nelson Mandela's closest aide.
What did he see in this white young woman who had this apartheid history and who was a lowly typist?
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the program. There are leaders sometimes who will define history for better or worse. Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu, Vladimir Putin. Platon has photographed all three. In fact, he's photographed more than 40 world leaders, including three US presidents. But it was Trump who surprised him the most. This is a man who's been president, who wants to be president again, Donald Trump, who's under criminal trial as we speak. What was that set up? What were you saying? I mean, he's way at the back of the frame.
This is, I've been told, one of his favourite rooms. It's the boardroom in Trump Tower, where everyone would get fired in his TV show. This is where he exercised power as a rehearsal, I think, for the presidency. I remember saying to him, Donald, let's just be human.
When was this?
This is before he was president, before even the election campaign started properly. And I said, let's be human together. I said, we've all followed your career. No one can doubt it's an extraordinary career path you've had. But there's always something about you. There's always an air of tension and controversy about things you say and do in public. And I'm sure it's intentional on your part. But it feels to me as if you're in the middle of an emotional storm. And I said, I can't live with that anxiety all the time. As a fellow human being, I'd like to know how you weather the storm. He calmly looked at me and he said, I am the storm.
Even then?
I had those words ringing out in my brain. Through the election campaign, through his presidency, through his post-presidency, and now we're in another cycle again. And I keep thinking to myself, there's only one person who can navigate perfectly through the storm, and that's the creator of the storm. So these people are very powerful, formidable, and they're much smarter than we make them out to be. And they are not to be underestimated. And I think we always seem to do that. He's smart.
One of the big issues that he brought to the fore others have, but he really made it a campaign issue, is immigration. Here's a picture of a mother carrying a picture of her boy, and this is about immigration across the southern border. Tell me what this is.
Well, this is a difficult story. Her name is Femina. She's from Guatemala, country ravaged by conflict, abject poverty, corruption, gang violence. Her parents were killed, grandparents were killed. She had trouble feeding her son, even, who was, I think, 8 years old at the time. His name was Omar. So she made the most difficult decision a mother could make, which is to leave your son behind with family members, cross over borders into the dangerous, deadly Sorinan Desert.
Because we also have a big picture of the morgue you took in Tucson. Yeah.
This is actually, this is the morgue, yes. And it was actually her son. She found this out the day I was to photograph her. So I did what my heart told me to do. I put down my camera and I gave her a hug. Christiane, I still remember the feeling of her pain going through my body like vibrations. And eventually, after a few seconds, she pushes me away. She was making the sound of a wounded animal. And she grabs the picture of her son that's framed and she says, take my picture now. I want the world to see my pain. So I took this picture.
And of course, a picture, these pictures do tell 1,000 words. And you can watch our longer conversation on my weekday show next week. And as always, you can find all of my interviews online at amanpour.com. Up next, from my archive, 30 years since Nelson Mandela's historic election win, his private secretary tells me how he changed everything, including her own life.
So you describe yourself as a racist. I mean, that is shocking for me to hear.
As I speak to you now, a man of 75, I feel like a boy of 16.
The indomitable Nelson Mandela on election day, April 1994, 1 month before he became South Africa's first democratically elected president, and finally ended the white supremacist apartheid system. In his inauguration speech, Mandela, who died in 2013, had a message of reconciliation that inspired the whole world.
Never, never, and never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another. The sun shall never set on so glorious a human achievement. Let freedom reign. God bless Africa. I thank you.
And from my archive this week, 30 years to this very day, Mandela cast his first ever vote. I revisit an inspirational conversation with his private secretary and close aide, Zelda LaGrange, who went from self-described racist to seeing the light. Zelda LaGrange, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How did a young girl like yourself, a whiter-than-white Afrikaner who believed in apartheid, end up working for the world's foremost black leader?
Well, you can add racist to that. You know, I was a full-on racist by the time I started working for him, which makes this so unlikely to happen. I applied for a job in his office as president, but working for his secretary, who was Miriam Kladana at the time. And she just desperately needed a typist, and I happened to be busy with an interview on that particular day for another position in the president's office when she came in and she said, I need someone right now.
So you describe yourself as a racist. I mean, that is shocking for me to hear. I mean, I suppose I should expect it. That was the system that you grew up under. It was a racist system. When Nelson Mandela was coming out of prison, what was the reaction in your household?
My father came outside. I was swimming in the pool on that day in February. And he came outside and he said to me, we are in trouble. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, the terrorist is being released. And I said, who's that? And he said, Nelson Mandela. And I continued swimming. It didn't affect my life. I didn't know who he was. My father apparently knew who he was. But to me, that was the totality of my understanding of what was happening in South Africa. I just heard this man's name, and really the system influenced us. We lived apartheid happily. And when I said to you I was a racist, you have to reconcile with your past. You have to admit these things to be able to change, to make a decision to change. So now looking back, if you asked me at the age of 23, I would probably have denied being a racist. Now it's easier because you can recognize the change in yourself.
You so happily believed in apartheid that you even voted no in the referendum to end apartheid.
Yes, yes.
What was it like then when you first met this man, Nelson Mandela?
Well, that was really the turning point in my life. When I started asking this question, he was kind, he smiled, he extended his hand, and he spoke to me in my own language. He spoke to me in Afrikaans. And that is the last thing you expect of him, because I was brought up to fear this man. And that just destroyed my defenses immediately. And I broke down and I was crying. And he said to me, no, you're overreacting. And if a president tells you you're overreacting, you pull yourself together very quickly. But which made me really ask, but is this man really something to be terrified of? Is he a person? Is he the person that I was brought up to believe or that I heard about?
What did he see in you? I know what you saw in him and how you changed, but what did he see in this white young woman who had this apartheid history and who was a lowly typist?
Probably the opportunity for him to mold me, first of all. He definitely recognized my commitment and loyalty, dedication.
Those were paramount.
And they were definitely needed for the job. The fact that I could dedicate myself 500% to the job is what worked for that position and what he needed. And then I would like to think maybe my sense of humor as well. We shared a very, very similar sense of humor. So I think, you know, that all worked well together.
And we've all heard that he was the only person who could call Queen Elizabeth II Elizabeth. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. It was fascinating to watch. And Mrs. Machel at one point said to Madiba, "You can't call her Elizabeth." And then Madiba responded and he said, "Well, she calls me Elizabeth. She calls me Nelson." So I think they recognized each other as human beings, each other's humanity. And I think the Queen enjoyed that, really.
Zelda LaGrange recalling Mandela's humanity in her book, Good Morning, Mr. Mandela. Today, though, South Africa is on the cusp of another critical election, and Mandela's beloved African National Congress could lose its majority for the very first time since his own historic win, with crime and corruption front and center for voters. Now, when we come back, remembering an American giant of journalism who was held hostage for years in the Middle East. Before we leave you, we want to remember an American journalist who was made to suffer intensely for his craft. Terry Anderson died this week at the age of 76. He had been taken hostage in Beirut by Hezbollah militants in 1985 while on assignment for the Associated Press. Helped by his Christian faith, he survived nearly 7 years in captivity, much of it chained and in solitary confinement. His daughter, Sulome, was born while he was being held hostage, so the first time they ever met, she was already 6 years old. They both told me about that extraordinary moment when I spoke to them back in 2016.
We flew to Damascus, where I immediately fell asleep on a couch in the American embassy, and my father woke me up. And it was quite a defining moment in my life.
It was a tremendously joyous moment, but I realize now, and I think you can see it if you look at all these pictures carefully, I was in some form of shock. It had been hours since I was in a cell, chained to the wall, and suddenly I'm here in Damascus and meeting my daughter and talking to the president and then the press conference and the lights and it was just, it was quite an impact.
He was the longest held American journalist. He was also a former Marine, a veteran of the Vietnam War. And after his release, he taught journalism at a number of universities. Salome said that her father would want to be remembered for his humanitarian work for many causes, including the protection of journalists. And that is all we have time for this week. Don't forget, you can find all our shows online.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.